May it please the Court. As the Court is aware, the action in this case was on September 26, 2005, and the tortfeasor, Bridget Roy, was uninsured. Enrique, through counsel, filed an uninsured motorist claim against State Farm, its her insurer, at least under the circumstances of this case, on July 22, 2008. And I mention the date in part because it relates to the uninsured motorist concept, because it was more than 2 years after the accident, which made it available to be filed at that point, given the decision in Spinelli that you have 3 years. The parties negotiated before the trial, and when the negotiations failed, State Farm advanced the plaintiff $25,000 against the coverage. It did not require release. It simply said, we failed. Here's the $25,000, and there's $75,000 left. On January 22, 2010, which was 30 days to the day before the February 22 trial, the plaintiff made a written demand pursuant to 6 Delaware Code Section 2301D. Essentially, the plaintiff said that she would take $65,000 more than the $25,000 previously paid, which would have resulted in a payment of $90,000 of the $100,000 coverage. The matter went to trial on February 22, 2010, and the result 2 days later was a verdict in excess of the coverage in the amount of $260,000. Prior to the trial, consistent with the Superior Court rules, the parties did enter into a pretrial stipulation, which was filed on January 26th, and by happenstance, that was 6 days following the Rapicelli decision issued by this court on January 20th. And we entered into a series of stipulations, and one of the stipulations under the admitted facts was that the verdict, or actually the recovery, would be limited to the remaining coverage, which was $75,000. And we also noted that it would be subject to the previous payment of $25,000. The plaintiff moved for costs and interest. Now, there was very little dispute about the costs. There was some concern about what we thought to be the excess amounts charged by Dr. Rowe. But except for that, we agreed to the costs. And the court eventually found some middle ground between what the plaintiff wanted and what State Farm was willing to pay for Dr. Rowe. The plaintiff sought interest on the entire verdict, which was the $260,000 less than $25,000. But what Judge Vaughn awarded was interest on the $75,000, and at that it turned out to be $32,000 at that point and counting. Now, what Judge Vaughn did was he concluded that there was a case in Connecticut, the Cox case issued by the U.S. District Court in 1991, which equated the interest with costs or expenses. The Cox case is actually a liability case and turns on the policy that the company, or the, I guess, Peerless Insurance Company issued. And what Judge Vaughn essentially said was that, well, if you have made a demand and that demand isn't sufficient, that the interest is not part of the damages, it is part of the cost. It's an expense. And which seems to me to be contrary to what the court said in the Rapicelli case. What the court said in Rapicelli, and of course I realize I'm speaking to the very court that actually made the decision last year, is that uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage is a hybrid. It's a hybrid of tort law and contract law to the extent that it requires a determination of the jury as to the damages and liability. It's tort, but to the extent that it can be relied upon or determined without determination of the jury, outside that presence, it's like, say, for example, coverage, that it's a question of contract law. And the court talked about the circuitous route that got us to the consistent point that there is a combination. And to the extent that 6 Delaware Code Section 2301 talks about tort, it still would apply to a UM or UIM carrier, because tort still applies under the circumstances, although the coverages are a different issue. And where I think that Judge Vaughn fell into error is that when the court, this court, said that interest is a part of the damages, for some reason Judge Vaughn decided that wasn't so and that interest is really an expense. If you read 6 Delaware Code Section 2301, it's actually fairly neutral on its face. The synopsis, the Senate bill synopsis, talks about encouraging carriers and what they call wrongdoers to make early offers for the early resolution of the case. Now, in this case, the demand was a month before the trial, but independent of that, it's pretty neutral. It doesn't require a good faith offer, and good faith is not an issue. It's simply that if you make the demand, it's open for 30 days, and the verdict is that amount or more, then interest goes back to the date of the accident in the case. And, of course, it applies.
Mr. Schock, I'd like to start with the policy itself.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree that if State Farm insured the tortfeasor, that State Farm, under the terms of this policy, would be obliged to pay not only post-judgment interest but also pre-judgment interest?
Up to a point, Your Honor, the policy, and it's at page A0025 in the appendix, and the section coverage A, it talks about interest after the judgment, but under subsection 2B, it says it only owes interest on before the judgment, but only in the part of the judgment that we pay. So I do not agree that it would owe judgment on anything, only on that part that we pay.
Well, that would be the $75,000 here, right?
Right, but still up
so
to the
limit. So the answer is that there would be pre-judgment interest paid by State Farm if you insured the tortfeasor?
I think so, Your Honor. But that's the way the Cox case went out, and the fact that in the Cox case, the insured Salvo had only $50,000 in coverage, and the verdict was $150,000 in coverage. I think the district court judge was concerned that since Peerless essentially controlled the entire defense of the case, he wasn't going to let the insured pay the interest on a judgment that the insurance company could have, or at least on a settlement the insurance company could have achieved within the policy limits. And that's an issue here, but it's always an issue. As a defense attorney and as an insurer, you're always concerned to try to make sure that the verdict comes within the terms of the coverage.
Now, as to uninsured motorist coverage, the policy is silent as to interest?
It is silent as to interest. It simply says under
So what is your position as to post-judgment interest?
I guess under the terms of the policy, unless there was something inappropriate about the policy, there is no post-judgment interest. It's simply subject to the terms of the policy.
All right. And then why doesn't the statute, as a matter of public policy, require the payment of not only post-judgment interest but pre-judgment interest?
Well, Your Honor, the statute itself is not a penalty statute. It's also a statute that doesn't necessarily attempt to make anyone whole, and that is by going back to the point of the accident and saying, okay, you're without this money. For example, an underinsured claim, it would be unfair if that was the issue because the UM carrier didn't avoid paying the claim and it didn't have any right to pay the plaintiff until the plaintiff exhausted those underlying limits. It is simply not a statute that makes anybody whole. The whole purpose of the statute, according to the synopsis, is to provide an incentive for insurance companies, a wrongdoer, to make prompt good faith offers of settlement. So to the extent that a person may not be paid interest after the judgment and during the pendency of any appeal, I don't see any public policy to be served in that matter.
Well, but the cases talk about the incentive to settle. So in this case, the carrier could have settled within the policy limits.
That's true.
And the carrier said, well, we're not going to do that, and the worst case for us is $100,000, and we're going to have a trial. Yet, because there was this demand that said, you know, you're on notice. If it comes in above our offer, you're going to have to pay interest. As a matter of public policy, what's wrong with the cases that say and that should be a risk that the insurer takes who decides to go to trial?
Your Honor, making the wrong decision on the amount to be either offered or accepted, it does not equate with bad faith. And the decisions that talk about, for example,
No, I'm not talking about bad faith. I'm just saying someone's going to be the decision maker. And if the decision is we're going to have a trial, and you're on notice that if you have a trial and the verdict is in excess of the offer, you have to pay interest, why shouldn't that fall on the decision maker?
Well, Your Honor, because I don't think statute is intended to punish people. And I think, as the Carney said, and I know that I used the word bad faith, and Your Honor said that's not the appropriate phrase. But if the insurer actually has made a decision that we know what our policy limits are, we're not going to pay anything because, look, we're protected from the policy limits, that may be evidence of bad faith. That's enough to protect the insured.
Well, in this case, where the verdict is 260 and you turn down 90, is that the type of fact that could lead to bad faith also?
Not in this particular case. You know, I tried the case. I know what happened, and I understand some of the things that changed before the trial, evidence about future surgery that didn't exist a few months earlier. I understand those circumstances. When cases develop over the course of time, sometimes they get better, sometimes they get worse, sometimes they change. When you make a decision, either as an attorney or as an insurer or as a plaintiff to try a case, you expect it to go in a certain way. If it doesn't go in that way, that doesn't mean that you made a wrong decision. It means that that jury on that day issues a decision. I've tried cases twice where I've had the same facts and had two entirely different verdicts.
Well, let's just come back to policy. I appreciate your answer. But what's the policy behind saying if you turn down a settlement offer and the verdict comes in that you should get the interest? What public policy is that trying to promote, irrespective of who's going to pay it? What's the policy?
Well, the concept, the public interest here, and I remember from the Rapicelli case, the court said where the literal interpretation of the statute and the policy behind it diverge, you take the policy behind it. Well, the policy behind this statute was to prompt early resolutions. It wasn't necessarily to punish anyone for making a wrong decision or to make that insured whole by going back to a particular date. Those are not the policies. The policies only say to that wrongdoer, not necessarily insurer, because the synopsis only speaks of insurers and wrongdoers, is to encourage an early resolution of the case. If it didn't do that, then it failed. And to the extent that there's coverage available against anybody, or to the extent that a wrongdoer might have to pay it out of pocket, then that's the consequence. But there are coverage issues, and when the insured made a payment, then that's what he limited to. That's he picked the coverage that he had.
Is there a sort of what I'll characterize perhaps unfairly as a negative inference in terms of incentive? Isn't part of the incentive to suggest to the insurance carrier, quite apart from whoever may insure the wrongdoer when the wrongdoer is insured, that you're going to be holding on to money by not paying it out during this period of time, and you're a sophisticated investor of that money, and you're making interest on money you don't pay. At the end of the day, when there's a jury verdict that suggests you should have paid your policy limits earlier, you're going to have to disgorge that interest. And one of the ways in which we incent you to settle early is to prevent you from earning interest on money and make you return it to the policyholder to whom you owed it.
The answer to that is no, Your Honor, for two different reasons. Number one, having had thousands of discussions with insurers over the course of time, the only discussion we've ever had, whether it be a liability case, although we're always concerned about the insured in a liability case, you're more inclined to pay that limit if, in fact, the insured might be personally responsible. But the only discussions we ever have are, what is the value of this case, given the liability?
I'm not talking about many of us have done insurance defense work in our careers, and I understand that's not an issue for you and the carrier you represent, and probably not an issue between you and plaintiff's counsel. But isn't an issue in the legislature when they talk about incenting settlement? Is it not just pay out early to avoid trial and the cost to the public of having trials, but it's also to readjust the balance here in terms of who has the money and who can earn interest on it between the person who's harmed and the carrier who insures them?
Well, Your Honor, I go back to the synopsis, which talks about insurance companies or wrongdoers. If it had just said to the insurance company, and it said we're going to, if the insurance company doesn't pay, and we're going to make sure they pay over the amount of the coverage, they could have said that. But, you know, statistically, and these are the stats that the Newcastle County Superior Court gives, 97 to 98% cases resolve short of trial. And I don't remember exactly how many cases were tried in the state of Delaware last year, but I know that it was under 100. So those incentives are already present. The insurers settle cases, plaintiffs settle cases, 97, as I said, to 98% of the cases resolve short of trial.
Okay.
What more incentive do they need?
All right, let's go back then to your original argument, this distinction between expenses and damages and how that plays out in terms of policy limits. Where did President Judge Vaughn get it wrong?
He found a word that I don't think has any legal meaning, and that is because expenses, it costs me tolls to come down here today. It costs gas. It costs paper. But what the court does in Rule 54 is it takes certain expenses and makes a decision that they're costs. So under Rule 54, costs may include, and I brought it along here, if I can find it. But in any event, whatever Rule 54 says is that it identifies certain things which become costs. So an expense is in and of itself not legally cognizable. It's just an expense. Everybody has expenses to prosecute or defend a case.
Are you suggesting he characterized it that way so it would be above and beyond your policy limits?
Perhaps. Because the only case that he relied upon was the Cox case. I know he said there was numerous cases, but the only one that he actually cited was the Cox case. And in the Cox case, the decision of the court was based upon a language in the policy which talked about costs and which said that the interest was simply a cost or expense of the lawsuit. He used the words interchangeably, as I recall.
Okay. When we use the term damages in Rapicelli, is it your view that what we must have meant was damages directly related to the injuries to the exclusion of interest on those on what may be owed in damages?
No, I think that you meant that it included interest, but interest as part of the damages. The damages led to the interest because the interest is calculated on the damages. Once you take a dollar amount, the jury awards a sum of money. That sum of money may be for pain and suffering, may be for special injury. It can be for any element that they consider as part of the tort claim. That sum of money is compensatory damages. It's nothing else. When you take the interest and you award it on top of the compensatory damages with the compensatory damages as the basic point, then it must be related to the damages. It can't be related to anything else.
Okay, and your position is that's under the umbrella of coverage?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think I've made my point. I think I've reserved some time. If, of course, any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the Court, William Fletcher on behalf of Joanne Enrique, the appellee in this matter. From a factual standpoint, regarding the effect of what's been called this rejected settlement offer statute regarding prejudgment interest and the arguments of State Farm, I would like to note that that since the filing of our answering brief, State Farm, in this case, has paid the $75,000 that represents the bodily injury damages. The State Farm has also paid all court costs in excess of $1,300, and State Farm has also paid the $2,000 for expert witness fees. So when you consider all of the monies that State Farm has paid to date, they have paid more than the policy limits of $100,000. They have paid $103,000, and the issue is whether or not, under their policy, they must pay the additional $32,000 of prejudgment interest, which is accruing beyond that on a daily basis.
So even if the policy limited it to bodily injury damages for uninsured motorists, then is it your position that they've waived the conditions of the policy?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the language of the policy, while it may be a bit subtle, I think State Farm has laid out exactly what its obligations are in both its liability and its UM coverages that actually mirror one another. As Your Honor pointed out, in the liability coverage, interest, whether it's post-judgment interest or pre-judgment interest, is considered to be an expense or a coverage item beyond the bodily injury limits.
But where's that language in the UM coverage?
It's not there per se, Your Honor, but here's what is there. What is there is the very first statement on page, I think it's 32 or 33 of the appendix, page A32. It talks about the payment of any amount due. And the first thing it says is, we will pay any amount due to the insured. And the amounts due to the insured include the jury award, include costs, include expert witness fees, and include interest, pre- and post-judgment. There is a listing, Your Honor, thereafter of...
Yes, sir. Disabuse me of this. That wouldn't, though arguably literally it would, mean $260,000 because that was the jury verdict.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does, and here's why.
Okay.
Once State Farm has made that general statement that we will pay our insured everything that we owe them, they then do identify seven categories of restrictions or limitations. And the first restriction is, as to bodily injury damages, it will be limited to the policy limit of $100,000. They talk about the property damage limitation. They talk about whether you've received some money from other sources. But there's all seven of them, Your Honor, on pages A32 and 33. None of them deal with a limitation or restriction on their obligation to pay court costs, expert witness fees, or interest. And since they say at the very beginning, we will pay all the amounts that we owe our insured, then they have to pay them unless they have written it out, which they've not, and they haven't limited it. So in effect, Your Honor, in the case of a UM carrier who is actually the one in the lawsuit and is actually a party, you have the very same setup as State Farm has in the liability, where it's not the party, but it's controlling the action, and it specifically says, in addition to the bodily injury limits, in this case of $100,000, we will pay post-judgment interest, pre-judgment interest, on the judgment amount that's covered, and costs of litigation.
Does anything in the UM statute itself require the payment of these defense costs, expert witness fees, interest?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is any specific language that comes to mind under 3902 subparagraph A, which is the general beginning of the obligation for UM coverage, that talks per se about these expenses. I don't believe it deals with it one way or another. It does deal with the fact that you're legally entitled to recover damages that are caused by an uninsured motorist. And you would have to consider the term damages in the statute as to whether or not it would include these items.
Would it be your position, if there were no Rule 54, that this policy would require the payment of the expert witness fees and other identifiable costs?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that is, court costs, it says court costs for any suit for damages. So if there's no Rule 54, I assume there wouldn't be an award of court costs. But particularly for prejudgment interest, the language specifically says, for interest before the judgment where owed by law. So if there is no law that requires them to pay it, there's no coverage for it.
All right.
And I believe we have a specific law that requires it in 2301 subparagraph D.
So the question is not whether it would be covered by the policy. And the question is, how is it characterized properly by the superior court? And if it's an element of your damages, as opposed to being an element of costs, that determination affects the application of the policy.
It does, Your Honor. The only thing I would say is, while State Farm is making that argument, when you look at its policy rejects that argument. But what the court is saying, I certainly understand what the court is raising, and that's why, in part, Judge Vaughn's ruling talks and addresses the Delaware statute as a rejected settlement offer statute. And that's because it's different. It's not as if a prejudgment interest is an element of the damages. No matter how egregious a tortfeasor may be, and no matter how horrific the injuries and damages he causes may be, under Delaware law, without the plaintiff making a good faith attempt to settle the case, and he just wants to go to trial and he wants to get the largest verdict he can get, he will not get any prejudgment interest under Delaware law. And so that's why it's connected to settlement negotiations. That's why this statute is different from some that just in a general way have provided for prejudgment interest that don't require any type of settlement.
So, in other words, you're saying it's never going to be part of the damages. What it is something that's an element of recovery independent of the damages based upon the rejected offer.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, the plaintiff, to even have an entitlement to this, the plaintiff obviously must make a reasonable settlement offer. The defendant must refuse it, and then there must be a trial, and the jury must award more than the offer. And until all of those things happen, a plaintiff in Delaware is not entitled to the recovery of this cost or expense or penalty, however the court wants to denote it, but it is not an element of a bodily injury claim in Delaware. And that's what I think Judge Vaughn was focusing on, and also what the Cox Court focused on when it noted that this type of cost related to settlement negotiations is really an expense associated with the defending of the case, with the strategy of how the defendant is going to handle the case, as opposed to it being an element of the underlying injury or damages caused by the uninsured motorist. And I think that Judge Vaughn aptly describes the purpose of this statute. It was not an attempt to simply broaden damages in Delaware to include prejudgment interest, as some states have done. What I do think it is telling that the State Farm policy treats these types of costs and interest different from bodily injury damages, even in its liability section. And it is consistent with the purpose of the statute. I think it's important to note that in Judge Vaughn's ruling, which we have accepted, in the case of the UM carrier, the interest is limited to being calculated on the bodily injury damages that are set forth in the policy limits, no more than that. And that's all that the plaintiff seeks in this case. And again, it seems to be a little incongruent for State Farm to be arguing that its limits are $100,000 when it's already paid more than that. Even as this this appeal was before the court, they went ahead and paid the court costs awarded by Judge Vaughn and the expert witnesses.
Yeah, but that's not hard to understand, is that they define some as expenses and others as element of damages, and you point out the reasons why their interpretation is incorrect.
But, Your Honor,
it's not an inconsistency.
It may not be, Your Honor, and all I would say is that it's an indication, though, that an argument that the maximum amount State Farm would ever have to pay out under their policy is that $100,000 limit is inaccurate.
Do you agree, Mr. Fletcher, that the jurisdictions or states are split on whether an insurer has to pay prejudgment interest in excess of the policy limit?
I agree, Your Honor, that there seems to be some a difference of opinion in some of the other states, but as I read those cases, Your Honor, I find that those states are dealing with a statute that merely makes prejudgment interest an element of damages. In other words, when you look at the Iowa statute or the Oklahoma statute or the North Carolina statutes that were cited by State Farm, those statutes simply say if the plaintiff recovers an element of his damages is prejudgment interest from, and then they pick a time, whether it's the time of filing suit or the time of the accident. But there is no requirement in those holdings and statutes, Your Honor, that a settlement ever be attempted. It is simply an element of the damages. The plaintiff never has to make a settlement offer, and he goes to trial, and he gets, if he's successful, whether it's more or less than what a defendant may have offered in negotiation, whatever the verdict is, prejudgment interest is added to it.
But it's kept by the coverage limit.
It is, Your Honor. In those states which have held that this type of statute, which has nothing to do with settlement,
no, I understand.
We're going to treat it as an element of damage.
When they say it's an element of damages, then it's capped at the coverage limit.
I think, Your Honor, when it's –
Because that's, after all, what the insured paid for, the coverage limit.
Unless it's capped at the limits of the policy, Your Honor. So I would – an interesting point on that, Your Honor, I guess, is one of the cases that the State Farm cited on this general statute without any settlement requirement, the court said, well, the policy doesn't provide for prejudgment interest, so you are limited to what the bodily injury damage limits are. But we know in State Farm, if Delaware had simply a prejudgment statute like Iowa or North Carolina, Oklahoma, which had nothing to do with settlement, they would have to pay, if this were a liability case, they would have to pay that prejudgment interest because they separate it out and they say that they will pay it. But that's so the courts in that state was looking at a particular policy that was written differently from State Farm's. But again, I think those statutes are totally different. They don't implicate the requirement of settling, which is the primary public policy to get cases settled, eliminate the need for trials, if possible.
If the policy said we will not pay prejudgment interest, now let's assume there's a specific exclusion. Is it your position that that's contrary to Delaware public policy?
Yes, Your Honor. Under our statute that deals with settlement, the requirement.
But
yes.
Only in the settlement context. When you make the offer to settle before trial, they reject or counteroffer for less than you've demanded, only in that scenario.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. I really have nothing else to offer unless the court has any further questions.
We have a continuing policy not to interfere when someone wants to quit early.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Five more minutes, Your Honor.
Can you tell us, since you're familiar with insurance policies, how this reference to prejudgment interest in the policy actually works?
Well, although you may think that I do, I've never actually used that provision in the policy. I've seen it, but I really don't know. I could guess, but that's all I'd be doing. I couldn't honestly tell you that I've used it.
Well, in this case, what's the basis for the argument that you don't pay prejudgment interest under the policy?
Well,
what Mr. Fletcher's saying is, you know, we've got the $100,000, and then we have what precedes it, and just looking at the policy, the prejudgment interest is an extra.
No, I didn't say that we wouldn't pay or State Farm wouldn't pay prejudgment interest, because it will, but up to the policy limits, because it is an item of damages, which is limited under the terms of the policy. The liability section of the policy, in order to protect the insured, and that's the primary focus of the liability policy, to protect the insured, they will pay prejudgment interest subject to certain conditions. There's just no provision for that in the UM portion of the policy. They simply say that we'll pay up to the limits. And have I answered the question?
Well, as I understood Mr. Fletcher's point, is he referred to language in the UM portion, we will pay any amount due to the insured. And then it lists limitations, and one of them is bodily injury, and then it goes on for other definitions, none of which exclude prejudgment interest, since in Delaware it's not an element of damages.
Well, Your Honor, in response to what Justice Steele said, but it's still subject to the limits of the policy. I mean, the verdict was $260,000. Now, we stipulated in the pretrial stipulation that the limit was the policy limits. But independent of that stipulation, if it had not been stipulated, we'd have simply referred to the policy itself. I mean, there's always a limitation, and in this particular case, it's the coverage limits. And it gets back to the argument that we're making.
I understood his argument to be that limits only apply to bodily injury.
Well, the bodily injury includes the damages subject to that. That's how you calculate the interest. It comes from the bodily injury. And
if I understand you correctly, it would be if they made a demand of $65,000, you paid $25,000, you offered to pay as much as $90,000, leaving $10,000 of coverage in effect untouched. If the verdict came back $100,000, from that $100,000, you would owe the entire $100,000, but no prejudgment interest. But if it came back $90,000, with prejudgment interest, you'd have up to $10,000 to put toward prejudgment interest.
Yes,
and you
sir.
Would have paid that.
Yes, you would have paid that. There's a question that Justice Ridgely asked, I'm going to respond to, about whether or not we could actually put something in the UM policy about not paying interest. And I think Your Honor asked a question about that. And honestly, I'd hate to be the one arguing that in front of the court some other day, essentially saying, oh, by the way, we're going to protect ourselves by getting around Section 2301 by putting in our policy that we will not pay any interest pursuant to that statute. That probably would be against public policy. At this point, we're simply saying that the interest is a measure of damages, measured against the damages that were awarded, and that's subject to the policy limits. The last point I want to make is the point that Mr. Fletcher made. He uses the word expenses, costs, and penalty interchangeably, as if somehow or other, if you do not get right the figure, you guess wrong in the figure you're offering, that there's a penalty involved here. And there's no penalty involved here. The statute's neutral on that. It encourages early settlements. As I said, you know, making a demand 1 month before the trial, and at that point, 4.5 years after the accident, probably didn't do much toward that effect. But facts aside, there's no penalty involved here.
And you help me understand, Mr. Chalk, where under the UM terms of the policy is the coverage for the expert witness fees and the cost?
You know, Your Honor, I didn't come prepared to answer that question, largely because in all the cases I've ever had, whether they be UM cases or liability cases, you know, because of Rule 54, talking about expert witness fees, and State Farm and other carriers have uniformly paid the costs. I don't think that anyone ever looks at the policy. I know I never have, and said to myself, when somebody awards a cost, I never tell the judge, by the way, we're excluded from the cost or we're somehow immune from that. I think a litigant is required to pay the cost. Have I looked in the policy for where that is? I have not. Have I looked into the policy, that is, in the larger sense, as to why a defendant pays the cost that the court orders it to pay? I haven't done that either. I don't know that there is a carrier in this state who's ever taken the position, at least not to my knowledge, that, by the way, we're a carrier, we don't specifically provide for it, we're not going to pay the cost. I can't imagine telling the trial judge that. And I know Your Honor's been a trial judge, and I can't imagine that and a carrier's ever stood before you and said, we're not going to pay the cost because we're immune from it.
But Justice Ridgely's question isn't about paying the cost within the policy limits. His question is, why do they pay costs or anything else above the policy limits?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question. I'd like to say that I could, but I didn't look in the UM's portion of the policy to provide for costs. I just know that Rule 54 provides for it, and the carriers are willing to pay it.
It's an accounting issue, too, isn't it? When they're setting their reserves, they do it based on what they think they're going to pay out in claims, but the definition of claims doesn't include expenses and cost of trial for the purpose of setting reserves any more than paying attorney's fees to their counsel.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I've talked to many a carrier over the course of time and pointed out that it would be easier to pay this particular amount than pay me. Sort of an eleemosynary advice
I offer.
But that doesn't affect them. The interest that the carrier has, I'm not talking about the concept of monetary interest, but their interest is in resolving the case within what they think the case to be worth. What it costs to get to the trial, whether it be their own defense costs, my costs, the costs of the experts, it usually plays little to no part in the decision-making process. They simply evaluate the case based upon what they think it's worth, and that's what they offer.
Well, Mr. Chalk, I think I understood Mr. Fletcher's position that the expert witness fees and the costs are covered because the language, we will pay any amount due to the insured, and then they're not excluded. So, and I understand you haven't looked at it, but I think it would be helpful for you to tell us in a letter, you know, what is the basis for coverage of expert witness fees and costs under the UM coverage.
I think that's fair, Your Honor. I rather doubt that it's the point that that's a section that Mr. Fletcher's talking about, but Your Honor's asked me to do something, I'll do it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Take the case under advisement and recess.